When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, John Daniel Davidson, senior editor at The Federalist. John, welcome back to Federalist Radio Hour.
Hey, Emily. Thanks for having me.
We're here today to talk about a story John filed with a note at the top that just read, Nerd Alert. It was on the new Amazon series based on, obviously, Lord of the Rings called Ring of Power. Is it Rings or Ring of Power? It's plural, right?
Oh, Emily. It's Rings of Power. Okay.
Yeah, Rings. John alternatively offered to start the podcast by reading poems in Elvish, which I sort of promptly rejected, although I do imagine I'm correct in assuming you would all enjoy
maybe
that.
Maybe we could make that bonus content, yeah. Like if you, I think people would enjoy it. And if you don't want to hear me reading poems in Elvish, I can just read out loud from the Silmarillion, you know, a couple chapters.
Just a couple, nothing too
for
much.
For context.
Right. Yeah, well, the context is crucial. And John has a kind of a rage post, but it's more than a post. It's a wonderful essay that's going up on Friday. So when you're listening to this podcast, you'll be able to read it. We're taping this on Thursday. But John, I actually wanted to start by asking you about something you absolutely don't want to talk about, but I think makes sense here in this context. We're taping this shortly after the news was announced that Queen Elizabeth had passed away and King Charles is the new monarch. Tolkien was writing in a time when a lot of the changes we're going to be reflecting on because of the Queen's passing were taking place. And that may seem like an odd connection to be made, but actually really Tolkien was, you know, in so many ways writing about this post-globalized, industrialized world. And he was doing it through the lens of ancient truths and biblical truths. But John, as people look back on the reign of Queen Elizabeth and just the 96 years of her life, what do you think Tolkien tells us? Or what can we glean sort of from Tolkien's observations about the world as we reflect on this century?
Yeah, it's an amazing life Queen Elizabeth had. I think somebody on Twitter today said that Queen Elizabeth's reign has spanned something like 30% of American history since our independence. That Queen Elizabeth became monarch when Winston Churchill was prime minister. Winston Churchill was first elected as an MP in 1900 during the reign of Queen Victoria, and Queen Victoria was born while George III was still alive. So the past is not past. It's not very far past anyway. Tolkien was very much against industrialization. He did not like industrialism. He did not like industrial capitalism. And yes, he was writing at a time when England was industrializing, when the West and Europe was going through major industrial changes, and it was changing English life and English culture. And he very much had a problem with that, not just sort of philosophically or ethically. He had a problem with it aesthetically as well. And just in terms of the, what he considered to be the humanness of what our what national life should be, what communal or village life should be, and what English life should be. and what it should be like. And so much of what he writes about in Lord of the Rings and in his Legendarium and the Silmarillion and all of the other writings and essays that sort of make up the Middle Earth mythology is, I mean, it's about a lot of things, but one of the things it's about is power, and that power tends to corrupt. It tends to bring forth evil. Power, the word power is always used in connection with evil. It's never used in connection with good in Tolkien's writings. And he always, you know, associates through the Lord of the Rings, anyone who's read it can see the connections. The evil characters, Sauron, Saruman, they employ mechanical and industrial arts and powers to impose their will and to conquer and to kill, and that very much was something that Tolkien lamented in his own country, was the industrialization of British life in the 20th century, which he lived through. You know, remember Tolkien, he was born in the 1898, I believe, and fought in the First World War, was wounded at the Somme, and it was during his convalescence that he began writing what would become sort of the first writings that became The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and The Silmarillion.
Well, I can think of no better way to transition into this conversation about putting Tolkien's work in the hands of Amazon, of a giant multinational high-tech
Absolutely.
Corporation that is now presiding over this intellectual property that is Yep. the world of Tolkien, which is fairly incredible. And seemingly, I have not watched the show, in full disclosure, because I'm going to be mostly poking John with questions because I'm sort of fascinated by this. But John, that to me is an incredible irony, and it's one that Amazon seems to have absolutely no awareness of whatsoever. And is that because in and of itself, we misread Tolkien? Our pop culture has misread Tolkien for years at this point, where you even have Elijah Wood, I think, and some of the other stars of Lord of the Rings coming out and using this sort of straw man and already virtue signaling in solidarity with, you know, the vulnerable people who are being railroaded by the criticism of the new show.
It wasn't enough for them to destroy Lord of the Rings. They want to destroy the Second Age now. Elijah Wood is probably the most miscast character in Peter Jackson's trilogy. Horrible choice for Frodo. Second maybe only to Aragorn. Viggo Mortensen was a horrible choice for Aragorn. We can get into that later.
Really?
To your point. Yeah. You know, they wanted to have Daniel Day-Lewis, who would have been a great Aragorn, but he wouldn't do it. He's a weird guy. I think he was living in Italy, in an Italian village, learning to be a shoe cobbler at the time, and that's where he stayed. To your point about Amazon, yes, Tolkien would have hated a company like Amazon. The idea of global, I mean, just the idea of global capitalism, I think, was deeply disturbing to not just to people like Tolkien, but also to G.K. Chesterton, to C.S. Lewis, to a lot of these guys, you know, to Tolkien and to Lewis, but also to the generation that preceded them, Chesterton, Ilar Belloc, a lot of these people who were thinking and writing around the turn of the 20th century and into the first decades of the 20th century, they saw industrial capitalism and mega corporations as threats to human flourishing, to traditional forms of religion and values and cultural practices. And something like a company like Amazon taking control of Tolkien's lore and his mythology, first of all, I think he wouldn't have even understood the appeal of a show like Rings of Power. He would have thought it was ridiculous, for one thing. And during Tolkien's life, in fact, you know, he was approached by Hollywood about adapting The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings early on, like back, you know, shortly after these things were coming out in the 1950s. And he thought it was absurd. He, you know, that he recounts at one point some Hollywood producers, you know, showing him kind of some storyboards. and he just laughs at the idea that this would be adaptable to a visual medium in the first place. And I think, you know, our experience of big budget adaptations of Tolkien has proved him right. I don't think that these things have done well as visual adaptations, as a film or movie adaptations. People can argue about and do argue about, you know, Peter Jackson's adaptations. And while they certainly have much greater fidelity to the source material than Amazon's Rings of Power does so far, I feel like in the aggregate, they failed as a trilogy. It failed. And it proved in some ways for all the effort and all the care that went into it. I don't think Peter Jackson was trying to change or truncate or water down or distort Tolkien's trilogy, this Lord of the Rings trilogy, but he nevertheless failed, I think, in important ways to capture the meaning of Middle-earth and the tone of that world. And I think it's because, as you say, we don't really understand anymore, or at least the people doing these adaptations don't understand the meaning of Tolkien's work and the what Tolkien was trying to do in creating this huge legendarium, this huge mythology for Middle Earth, this whole other world. To say that Amazon doesn't understand it is an understatement. You know, part of me, having watched the first two episodes, thinks, not only did they not understand it, they're trying to change it. They want to destroy it. You know, and why do they want to destroy it? Because what it stands for and what Tolkien stood for is anathema to everything that the people who, the elites in Hollywood and at places like Amazon stand for today.
So many Americans are looking for alternatives to the stock market and are looking to diversify their 401ks into more stable assets. It is considered prudent to place a portion of your retirement income into a precious metals IRA or to invest directly in gold or silver. There are many tax benefits associated with such an investment. Savvy investors know that gold has historically outperformed the stock market and helped the wealthy protect their assets through rough financial storms. Goldman Sachs analysts expect gold to rise to $2,500 by the end of 2022. Now is the time to protect your IRA with precious metals. Call the experts at Allegiance Gold, 844-790-9191. Allegiance Gold has been helping Americans protect their retirement and legacy for years. And when you call today, you'll get a bonus $500 in silver free for all qualifying accounts. Just mention this ad. Call 844-790-9191 today. That's Allegiance Gold, 844-790-9191, and get your $500 in silver today.
When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online, schedule package pickups through the dashboard, and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
So I'm really interested in your take on the Peter Jackson trilogy, which he also then oversaw the Hobbit trilogy as well. And we can get into all the
various... Which also failed.
Yeah. So the Hobbit, in full disclosure, I've never read all the way through Lord of the Rings, but I love The Hobbit and I've read it more times than I can count, and would probably agree with your description or your analysis of the Peter Jackson Hobbit trilogy. That said, in what ways is Amazon replicating and exacerbating the failures of the sort of commercialization of Lord of the Rings that's probably best exemplified by the Peter Jackson trilogy?
One of the things off the top of my head is aesthetically. There's a kind of like gauzy, light diffused, ethereal atmosphere to Peter Jackson's trilogy that is almost cliche as it's a fantasy world, right? But it's not a fantasy. People make the mistake of thinking, oh, Tolkien wrote a fantasy series. Tolkien didn't write a fantasy series. Tolkien invented fantasy as a genre. So the fantasy novels that have come out over the past, 60 or 70 years since Tolkien first published his trilogy are imitations and cheap imitations of what Tolkien did. What Tolkien did, no one had ever done before. So when The Hobbit was first published, I think in 1937, and then was followed over the next 15 years by Lord of the Rings trilogy, no one knew what to do with it. Critics were like, what is this? Why has this Oxford philologist written this weird story that there was no category for it? Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and his contemporaries, they knew what he was doing. He was writing what they would call fairy stories, mythology in the vein of Northern European mythology, Nordic mythology. And Tolkien understood what he was doing to be creating a mythological legendarium for Britain and Northern Europe, which he thought didn't exist. Or at least a mythology for Britain that was pre-Christian, so not the Arthurian legends, that could be for Britain what the mythologies of ancient Rome or Greece or the Nordic mythologies were for Northern Europe. So it was a very, very ambitious, project that he had undertaken, and he spent his whole life working on it. So when it appeared, a lot of critics and reviewers didn't understand it at all. Some did. The poet W.H. Auden lent early and very vociferous support to Tolkien's work. He was a student of Tolkien at Oxford. Auden was. And others, of course, lent their support as well. But the reviews were very mixed because there was no way to categorize what this was. Now, of course, in the decades since, we all know what fantasy, as a genre of literature is. But I think what Peter Jackson did, to get back to your question, and what Amazon has continued in their vein in terms of the tone of the visual landscape, and the tone and the feel of the world, the visual worlds that they've created, is like they have overlaid Tolkien's lore with the sort of tawdry and sometimes embarrassing fantasy literature that came after Tolkien. It was maybe inspired by a misunderstanding of what Tolkien was doing, or was just just opportunistically used by future authors to say like, I'm going to create a novel series with elves and dwarves in it and other creatures in it too, and it'll just be like a cheap knockoff of Tolkien, but it'll be empty. In other words, these other fantasy worlds, even ones like George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones, it's an empty world in the sense that it doesn't really have there's no real world there behind the stories. Tolkien wrote the stories after he had conceived of the whole history and even the language. He invented a language. It started as a linguistic project. And so he realized that to flesh these languages out, he needed the legendarium. He needed a whole history. And it was out of that sort of world-making, myth-making project that these individual stories emerged. No one else has ever done that. And I would venture to say Tolkien's work, not just The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, but Tolkien's corpus of work is unlike anything ever produced in the English language. It's one of the greatest works of literature ever done in English language. And when it appeared in the middle of the 20th century, nothing like it had been done in 1,000 years. Now, maybe I'm an extremist.
an evergreen admission from John.
But that's a very long answer to your question. They overlaid this gauzy fantasy genre bullshit that had nothing to do with Tolkien's work onto Tolkien's work. And that, I think, from the very first scenes of Rings of Power, it's like, okay, they're sort of like following in Peter Jackson's aesthetic footsteps here with this sort of the visual feel of this world.
Interestingly enough, I actually want to keep pulling at the visual and the aesthetic thread, because the world of Middle Earth created by Peter Jackson does not connect remotely with the world of Middle Earth that I had when I was reading the books. And it seems like that's probably a similar critique to
right.
yours. And it seems that there's a step forward from my perspective in Rings of Power, and that it's a slightly warmer aesthetic, and that there's something different about it. But to your point, people keep saying it just looks like a really high-tech video game, like a very hyper-realistic fantasy video game. But fantasy in and of itself is kind of a post-Tolkien creation. I wanted to ask, have you seen the 70s cartoon adaptation of The Hobbit?
Yes. I saw it as a kid.
So, yeah, and it's still on YouTube. People can watch it if they haven't. But there's an incredible difference between the Peter Jackson version, which is like almost very, like he was making a war movie about, and it's not really detached from the human experience, might be a way to put it. Like it feels, the Peter Jackson Middle Earth feels very human, even if you have mythical creatures. But there's something that they don't get about Tolkien. And as you were talking, I wanted to see if you could be even more specific about like what that is, what they're physically missing. When we're looking at it, what's physically missing?
Tolkien's world, as it appears on the page, is there's something that's solid about it that is missing from Peter Jackson and from Amazon series. There's something more solid about it. It's darker. I think that the cartoon adaptation in the 70s actually was aesthetically did a better job of capturing when you think of like fairy tales, right? Fairy tales that we're familiar with, Hansel and Gretel, let's say. Mm-hmm. It's dark, you know? These kids go into the woods and then like a witch kidnaps them and they have to kill the witch. Like if there's nothing gauzy or lighthearted about it. Like fairy tales are dark partly because they reflect the darkness in the human heart and the struggle between good and evil that's sort of within each person, that's also playing out on a cosmological level between Satan and God, right?
Yeah.
And so when people say, oh, the new Rings of Power series feels off, I think they're tapping into the same feeling that people had when they said, people like me and others who said the Peter Jackson series felt off too. It felt too lighthearted. It felt too ethereal. It didn't feel grounded enough in reality. It didn't feel solid enough. It didn't feel grim enough. Like Aragorn, for example, should have been like a grim dude. There was nothing lighthearted about him. He like to understand, and they would have made him a lot grimmer and a lot more solid and a lot more of like a badass, and maybe somebody who is not as like, you know, with not such a high voice and as scrawny as Viggo Mortensen, if they'd understood who Aragorn was, you know?
Only John Daniel Davidson considers Viggo Mortensen scrawny.
He's scrawny.
The John Daniel Davidson who I'm currently talking to in the remote wilderness with a literal bear pelt hanging from the ceiling next to him, which you can't see, but I can see it. And wow, that's perfect.
There's also, I'm also looking at a bear skull. I'm not kidding.
Can't have one without the other. Everyone knows that.
So, well, you got to kill the bear to get the pelt.
Yes. There's a, and I don't want to get into this like semantics, but it's interesting to me that you said it doesn't feel grounded, because to me, it didn't feel transcendent in the way that a cartoon can, for instance. Like, the cartoon can really replicate the fairy elements in a way that now we certainly have.
Without being cheesy, like without being corny.
Yeah. And being so, it just to me looks like a human war movie as opposed to the sort of transcendent fairy story and narrative, because it's just people can't wrap their heads around the transcendent anymore. And that's a good, like a good segue into the next thing we should talk about, which is the idea that Amazon is going to do an adaptation of Tolkien and is going to extend the world of Tolkien in 2022 in a way that has any fidelity to what Tolkien did in the early 20th century. By the way, as you're saying, Lord of the Rings published 11 years after Queen Elizabeth was born, I believe. Like, it's incredible to think back on the last century of human development. But John, where is Amazon straying furthest from Tolkien in this adaptation? We've covered the aesthetics. Now maybe is the sort of other points that you touch on in this piece as well.
Yeah, the piece is focused on the ways that they depart from Tolkien's lore. So it's for nerds by a nerd. Nathaniel Blake had a great piece for us earlier this week about how the show creators strayed from Tolkien's moral imagination. And so I didn't, you know, he covered that very well. And we can talk about that later too. But the ways that they deviated from Tolkien's lore, I think, are also important because it shows either that they don't understand what they're adapting, or they don't like what they're adapting and they'd like to change it into something that they think is better. They'd like to improve upon it, which to me is sort of insane hubris to think that you can improve on Tolkien's work. They've now shown the you know, a gaping world that they cannot improve and have not improved on Tolkien's work. They've made it into a stupid video game fantasy series that's laughable. The idea that Galadriel, for example, Galadriel, you know, of course, is this elven queen famously portrayed by Kate Blanchett in the Peter Jackson series. The idea that Galadriel is like this battle elf and she's like this commander of a scouting party and they're hunting Sauron totally misunderstands what Galadriel is supposed to be, what she's supposed to represent, who she actually was in the Legendarium. She's not a military commander. She's a queen. She rules over vast realms. She's, you know, by the beginning of the Second Age, she's thousands of years old, you know. The idea that Gil-galad, who's the High King of the Elves in this new Rings of Power series, could order her around, you know, or could be severe with her or show magnanimity toward her is absurd. As I note in my piece, he may technically outrank her as the High King of the Elves, but she's much older than him, and by relation, she's something like his great aunt. So he doesn't just order, he has no power to order Galadriel around the way they're depicting it as some sort of like, in other words, the whole way they're depicting the elves and the relationship of the elves to one another and how their society is structured, they're overlaying a kind of like cheap fantasy Game of Thrones kind of structure onto something that's much more complex and much richer and probably unfilmable. Okay.
It's right.
That's the other thing that they've done. They've collapsed thousands of years of timeline so they can film this thing. But in doing so, they've destroyed a lot of the significance of these characters and made it incomprehensible. For example, just to really nerd out on you,
I'm having a really hard time with this. And I knew
listen,
I was
listen.
Going
well,
to.
You haven't read the books and you haven't seen the series too. But anyway, there's a scene in the first episode of Rings of Power where Gil-galad, the High King, he offers to Galadriel and her troops as a reward for their service passage back to the undying lands of the Valinor. Okay. Anyone who's familiar with the Legendarium would know that that's idiotic. Okay. That's an idiotic thing to do. Gil-galad can no more offer passage back to Valinor than he could, you know, beam them there or go there himself. The Valar decide who goes back to Valinor, and the Valar are the gods or the spirits or the angels, what have you, of Arda, of this world, and they come from the thought of Iluvatar, who is God. Now, why does Amazon, why does Amazon not get into all that?
Yeah.
Amazon doesn't get into all that because now you're starting to get close to Tolkien's Catholic imagination, his sacramental view of reality. So you don't want to get too far into Tolkien's lore because you have to start dealing with things like God and angels and demons and eternal life and mortality. These are really the really big things that Tolkien was grappling with and that he was using this mythology that he created as a way to expound and explore and delve into these eternal truths. And Tolkien believed, as did C.S. Lewis, that mythology was a way of exploring and expounding eternal truths that no other sort of form, literary form, could quite do.
Right.
And that's one of Tolkien's main motivations for doing any of this, right? Was to get into these things. Amazon is not going to get into this. And so not only because I think they're incapable of it, but I don't think they want to. And so they're going to make a Game of Thrones with like Tolkien names.
I was just going to press on exactly that dichotomy you just raised, which is you said, and again, like I knew I was going to have problems with this because I love it when people start to get into the weeds on Tolkien. I find it so hilarious and I'm so sorry. No, I'm not sorry for anybody who I offend. It's just so funny. I have this great memory.
I fail to see what's hilarious about it. Okay.
You're like,
I fail.
They're collapsing thousands of years of history. No, my boyfriend who John
sometimes
knows.
I take that a voice like that and I'll read what I'm writing out loud to my wife. I'm like, there is no way Gil-galad could offer passage to Valinor. And then
so
she'll record me. She'll record me and like text our friends.
That's at least
video of me doing that.
Unlike Amazon. Yeah. But no, my boyfriend, who John knows, I've forced him. He did not want to do this. I think I was sick or something to watch The Princess Diaries 2, one of my favorite movies. And Jonathan Rhys-Davies plays one of the characters in Princess Diaries 2. And as soon as he comes on the screen, my boyfriend bolts off the couch and just goes, "That's Gimli, son of Glóin." And
good
I
man.
Just I can never get over the fact that he didn't say Gimli, he said Gimli, son of Glóin. Anyway,
that's awesome. That is awesome. I'm gonna congratulate him next time I see him. I will say, since we're sharing personal stories, I told my wife that, you know, they're gonna come out with one of these episodes of Rings of Power every Friday, you know, for like years, I guess. You know, they have like five seasons that they're going to come out with. I hope the whole thing implodes before it gets to that point. But so I was like, you know, I watched the first two episodes on my own so I could write about it. And I was like, I'm going to keep watching them because I'm going to keep writing about it. And like sort of like, you know, thundering away at how horrible this is. So, you know, you should probably watch the first two episodes so that, you know, if you want to watch these episodes with me, you know what's going on. And so I convinced her. She's like, I really don't want to. Not that she likes Tolkien, but she just doesn't, you know, she's suspicious, and she knows that I hated them. And I was like, look, just watch them. I'll watch them with you. Let's just watch them so that, you know, in the future, you know, you know what's going on. We sat down last night to watch. We got 20 minutes into it, and she's like, I am not watching any more of this. This is so stupid. And she's like, it's not. And she isn't into the lore like I am. She's like, this is stupid. It's just stupid. On, like, even if you didn't know anything about Tolkien, it's just dumb. The acting is horrible. All the lines are delivered like idiotically and like woodenly. She doesn't care about any of the characters. It's completely slow moving. The CGI is horrible. Like the ridiculous sword battle between Galadriel and the snow orc or whatever. She's like, it's just embarrassing. She's like, I feel embarrassed for all these people who participated in this show watching this. And she insisted that we turn it off and watch Sylvester Stallone's Samaritan instead. At the end of which, she was like, that was way better than Rings of Power. I couldn't disagree.
Yeah, right. Well, but this is what's so, like, this is the most expensive television series ever produced, period. It is a major expense of one of the biggest corporations in the entire world, and that has ever existed in the entire world. They're spending a truly incredible amount of money adapting Tolkien and resources adapting Tolkien. And to what you said at one point, you said, you know, anybody who's familiar with the Legendarium would know that this is impossible. But also, even if Amazon, you know, knew that, you said both they're incapable and unwilling to grapple with the fundamental, deepest truths that Tolkien is exploring. Right. And so that's what I wanted to ask you about. Is this a combination of being incapable or unwilling, or is it truly you actually have people who, let's say, for instance, are familiar with the Legendarium, who really, to the point of your piece, which folks should go read, want to destroy Tolkien?
I think that there is an iconoclasm ascendant in our culture right now that permeates everything. That, and especially everything that's undertaken by our elites. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that Jeff Bezos and the showrunners of Rings of Power would look at something like Tolkien's Second Age and think, you know, this is an opportunity for us to kind of like insert our values and insert our, you know, woke, progressive 21st century messages and graft it onto this beloved, you know, these beloved stories. I think that that happens without them almost even being conscious of it.
Do they understand the deepest themes of Tolkien? Because I suspect that it's been so secularized over decades and decades that they don't.
No, I don't think they do. I don't think they do at all. And I think that Tolkien's work has been so commercialized and pop culturalized, if I can say that, by Peter Jackson, by the Hobbit trilogy, by all the video games, you know, that have come out since then, and now by Amazon, that a lot of people are familiar with, like, the world of Tolkien, and they've never read the books. They certainly maybe have never read, like, the Silmarillion, for example, that really, you know, which Christopher Tolkien's son, published shortly after Tolkien's death, and where he combined a lot of the Legendarium into a single volume. I don't think that they're aware of what it's supposed to be about, but I also think that in their whole mindset, they're like, whatever it's supposed to be about, it's also supposed to reflect our values.
Right.
And that there's like this imperative that they show, for example, that Middle Earth is for everybody. Okay. So we're going to have non-binary characters in it. you know there's going to be a non-binary character in this series. Just well, you just know there is.
And
there's also the
there's like nonsensical diversity, right? That like just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, the racial diversity doesn't make sense. I'm not opposed to them taking some license, you know, in casting. It's a billion-dollar adaptation of a giant corpus of work. But you get the sense that the casting, the multiracial character of the cast, having sort of multiracial elves, multiracial dwarves, multiracial hobbits, was sort of something that they thought that they would like, oh, we'll do this and it'll trigger the white supremacists and we'll show how progressive and tolerant we are. We can show that Tolkien's Middle Earth is for everybody. Even when like it doesn't make sense in terms of Tolkien's legendarium, right? Like hobbits very clearly are like pre-industrial Englishmen, like rural, pre-industrial rural Englishmen. That's what hobbits are. So they're going to be racially homogenous. Like there wasn't a lot of like racial diversity in the pre-industrial English countryside, right? There wasn't a lot of racial diversity in prehistoric Northern Europe. Okay. Sorry, there just wasn't, you know, it would make about as much sense as like adapting a series about the fall of Troy and casting like a bunch of Chinese and East Asian characters,
right?
You know, not that there's anything wrong with being Chinese or East Asian, but like, what are you doing in Troy?
Or an all white Mulan, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like it doesn't make any sense. So even some of the, you know, even some of the like familial relations, like there's a hobbit, excuse me, Harfoot character. I'm not even going to get into that. Okay.
Yeah, we'll just table that one.
So a white actress is portraying this hobbit girl, and her mother is clearly black. And it's not that they like, you know, and her father is white. And so it's not that they're like, okay, we have like a you know, a white hobbit father and a black hobbit mother. So, you know, we're going to get a multiracial hobbit girl to, you know, actress to play this role. No, they're just like, they just want you to like, I don't know, suspend your sense of like reality and just say, oh yeah, they're all these hobbits. They're all different races and there's no rhyme or reason even to like their family relations. Like it used to be any race, you know? And I think that they, that is part of their not very well thought out, you know, moral crusading that we're going to lay our sense of like racial justice and inclusion over and on top of Tolkien's work. Even if it doesn't make any sense. And if you're offended by that, then you're a racist.
Well, and there's no world as meticulously crafted as that of Tolkien.
Right.
And that's what's, you know, it's not about the, to me, it's more about the way you get people to suspend their disbelief in movies is by following your rules. It's by following a set of rules that you lay out. And, you know, if you're like just willy nilly on that, it makes the whole project seem less of, it makes the whole world seem less real. And thus it's less easy to sort of access the message. And we referenced this earlier, but, Elijah Wood, Sean Astin, they are wearing, hats and t-shirts that say, "You are all welcome here" in Elven script because of some of the online backlash to the casting. And this is from the Mary Sue. They got that from non-binary artist Chris, who describes themselves as Tolkien Talks resident elf boy. Okay, so John. Okay, so pretend you have some time to sit down with Tolkien Talks resident elf boy, B-O-I is how it's spelled, boy. How would you, you know, what's your elevator pitch on Tolkien and postmodernism that people are just, I truly don't understand how you miss that in Tolkien.
I would submit to elf boy. I don't know why you're doing this to me, Emily.
For the good of mankind.
I just, I just want to be left alone with my Tolkien appendices and my Silmarillion. And my bear pelt, wrapped in my bear pelt, reading my Tolkien. I would submit to Elf Boy that that they should go back and read Tolkien carefully, and read maybe also Tolkien's letters. Tolkien, as many men of his era and education did, wrote a copious amount of letters, and he talks a lot about his project, which was one of the, was his great creative undertaking in his life, and it spanned most of his life. He literally was working on it right up until he died. With his son Christopher Tolkien, who just died a couple of years ago, actually. And the letters explain a lot of his motivations and a lot of his thoughts about the characters and about the development of the characters and even the theology of Middle Earth, and working through really specific questions, like even questions that he never quite fully answered, like where do orcs come from? And that was a problem for Tolkien, the idea that Morgoth would have created orcs, because evil in Tolkien's moral imagination, which is, to be clear again, is a thoroughly Roman Catholic moral imagination. Evil can't create good. It can only imitate and ape good. It can only mangle or mar something that is created. Or I should say, evil can't create life, right? So Morgoth couldn't create life. And so the idea was that Morgoth didn't create the orcs, because he can't, being an evil being, he can't bring forth life. He captured elves and corrupted them into orcs. Anyway, that may be not important in and of itself, but it illustrates that Tolkien himself understood that he was playing by a certain set of rules, and that the world that he created didn't just need to be sort of chronologically hold together or narratively hold together. It needed to theologically hold together. And it needed to theologically hold together because he was engaged in a deep theological and philosophical project. And so if you don't understand that about Tolkien, then you don't understand anything important about Tolkien. Well, and you're gonna get caught up in the fantasy and in the visuals and in the aesthetic that really came after Tolkien by imitators and pulp fiction, writers.
So, John, as we think about this idea that Amazon is somehow the steward of Tolkien's universe and Tolkien's moral imagination at this moment, a lot of people, kind of a recurring theme of this podcast, don't think about certain things Tolkien was living through as technology, because the rate of change has increased so fast that that still remains, in sort of the scope of human existence, massive technological breakthroughs and early ones. We're still early in the phase of lights and air conditioning and certain medical technologies. Tolkien is grappling with this very early onset, and Queen Elizabeth, again, we're talking about a 96-year-old woman that was has been the queen since Churchill. This is incredible, and it says Tolkien has a lot to say about the industrialization of Britain, the industrialization of the West, globalization, the British Empire. When we find that it's very difficult for people to access the truth of Tolkien in the sort of postmodern 2022, right. What did Tolkien himself tell us about why that might be difficult?
Why it might be difficult to understand
what, Tolkien?
To understand what he was doing.
Yeah, if the world.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying if the sort of changes to human society that Tolkien is witnessing in their Genesis, if he's seeing these and critiquing them, and if that world comes to pass, which it has in 2022 in ways that I don't think even people then would have realized, what would Tolkien himself, you know, what do we know from Tolkien himself about why that might have happened, about why a hyper-capitalist, hyper-technological society is now incapable of grappling with his moral imagination?
Because they've been corrupted by power. Because they've been corrupted by power and the desire to wield power over the created world, by a rejection of the profound truth that our physical world is overlaid and shot through with a spiritual world from which it draws its vitality. Tolkien understood the industrial mindset to reject all that in favor of a cold, scientistic mindset that saw the world only as material to be manipulated for the sake of wielding and exercising and accumulating power. And he would weep at what the world has become. And if we understood better what he understood, then we would weep too, I think.
I'm trying to, you know, get, I want to think about that in the context of Jeff Bezos and Amazon, just as we kind of wrap up here, because conservatives have loved Tolkien through, you know, the last century and through, I guess, some of what people would coin or would term as free market fundamentalism of the conservative movement in the West, through whether it's Margaret Thatcher or George W. Bush, whoever it is. John, what lessons exist about power, or what should people, maybe if they go back and instead of binging Rings of Power, they watch or they read the books, what is in there for us as we think about the fidelity to free market capitalism, which, you know, I think both you and I understand is an engine for human flourishing in many different ways. But that doesn't mean we just sort of are totally laissez-faire, of course. So what does that mean to Tolkien's moral imagination?
I think that we need to, and I think a lot of people are at this, you know, are beginning to reckon with it on the right anyway, seeing the limits of free market capitalism and seeing the dangers of it and seeing, you know, sort of taking a step back and looking around at the world it's created, companies like Amazon, these kinds of massive corporations, I think, are by nature wicked. Morally, they're morally wicked. And if it means that our, you know, life has less convenience or things cost more because we can't order them online and have them delivered later that day to our doorstep, that is a price that I am willing to pay to return to a way of living that is more grounded in the eternal truths of human community and family and connection to the land and a more wholesome way of living. You know, I don't want to just wax on and on about this. I think specifically, you know, Tolkien wasn't against, and not just Tolkien, Chesterton, a lot of these other guys around the same time, they weren't against private property. They were against industrial capitalism, and they, I think they understood something that Christians for many centuries understood, that the desire for wealth is not a good thing. It is not a good thing for human beings to desire to accumulate wealth and power. And I think that they would argue we have to return to a kind of Christian fellowship that is not based on the idea of a neutral free market or a society that's based on Christian fellowship and not based on a neutral free market and a neutral state. In some ways, they were sort of post-liberal. And a lot of the people who are talking about post-liberalism now are tapping into something that's not brand new. People have been talking about this for over 100 years. And they saw the problems of industrial capitalism as it was emerging. It's easy to see the problems now. I think it was harder to see it in the 1920s and 30s, but certainly after the First World War. And certainly if you experienced the First World War, like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien did, you could see the problem with industrialization. They saw industrialized war for the first time, something that no one had ever seen. And I think they rightly understood what the implications were for all of society once you unleashed sort of this mechanized industrial technology onto our farms, onto our production of food, onto how we organize our cities, how we organize our schools and our colleges and universities, how we conduct manufacturing. And they were concerned. And I think that their concerns have been totally vindicated. And that if we want to understand what they understood, we are going to have to go back and interrogate some of our assumptions about free market capitalism and the extent to which we want a society that is built on free market capitalism and what that actually costs us in terms of these other more durable spiritual and material goods, cultural goods, because I think it's going to cost us everything.
It's just an incredible point, because the First World War and its effect on those writers, and I mean, if you read Screwtape Letters, the war plays a very large role in how Lewis is sort of thinking through sin and mortality and just biblical reality. And that was a sort of industrialized war, and it forced this conversation about these technologies that we just sort of went right through. We just sort of pushed right through it. And Tolkien ended up selling like hotcakes, and Amazon, the biggest corporation, one of the biggest corporations in the world, is now the steward of his message. And that's where I was trying to push John on that connection between a sort of fundamentally anti-globalist, anti-high-tech text being co-opted time and time and again by the wealthy and powerful. It's a tale as old as time in some ways, and it's sort of exactly what he's talking about in terms of power.
Much like the Steward of Gondor wanted to use the ring to defeat Sauron, the steward of Tolkien's estate now, Amazon, seeks power. And doesn't understand the power that they have and that they're wielding. You used the word steward twice, and so I had to weave in the Steward of Gondor, who was not a wholly bad character, but he was wrong about the ring. The great lesson of the ring is that you can't use it for good. And Tolkien did not do allegory. The stories are not allegorical, but there is a strong sense in which the ring can be understood as this object of great power. And to the extent that we understand technology and industrialization and industrial capitalism as an object of great power, what I think Tolkien would have us understand is that we cannot control it. We cannot wield it for good. We cannot direct its path, and we will become slaves to it. What does power and the ring always do in Tolkien's world? It enslaves. And I think he would say that the powers that we have unleashed have enslaved us here in the beginning of the 21st century.
That was beautiful, John. It really was.
Thank you.
While we were talking, I texted my boyfriend, "Who the hell is Morgoth?" He responds with an eye roll emoji and just says, "One of the Valar. He's an immoral spirit who was corrupted by evil in the Silmarillion."
It's pronounced Silmarillion, Emily. Silmarillion.
Whatever. I don't know. I can't read.
You have your reading homework cut out for you, I see. And you know, if your boyfriend doesn't follow up with you, then I'm going to. Hopefully we'll both be quizzing you in the weeks to come.
Yeah, I'm going to be speaking Alvin by the time we...
Next time we do a podcast on Rings of Power, we'll conduct part of it in Elvish.
Yeah, I don't see why we wouldn't.
I think people would like that.
John Daniel Davidson, senior editor at The Federalist, thank you, as always, for stopping by Federalist Radio Hour.
Thanks for having me, Emily. It's my pleasure, as always.
Make sure to go read John's story. It is up on thefederalist.com. He is still banned from Twitter, so you can't follow him there, but make sure to follow him over at thefederalist.com. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fight.
I heard the faint voice of reason, and then it faded away.